Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and infertility. Today's show will be on genetics versus environment, which one is most important in shaping who we are. Creating a Family is a weekly radio show, podcast, and to make sure that you automatically hear about each episode, subscribe to our show at either iTunes or on the radio page of our site, creatingafamily.org/radioshow. I'm Dawn Davenport. I am the Executive Director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education Organization, and we provide unbiased, accurate information pre, post, and during adoption, as well as to the infertility patient community. This show, the Creating a Family show, is underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring has a Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card, which helps patients, both cash-paying and insured patients, save money on their fertility medications. To get more information on the Heart Plus Pharmacy Savings Card, you can talk to your doctor, or you can go to the Ferring website at ferringfertility.com/heart. And this show, as well as all the many resources we provide, including our website, our videos, our extensive social social media networks, could not happen without the generous support of our sponsors. And these are professional organizations, professional entities that believe in our mission of providing you unbiased, accurate information, and they're willing to support it. We have Children's Connection, Inc. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas, providing domestic infant adoption, embryo donation, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. We also have Bethany Christian Services. They provide post-adoption support to all members of the adoption triad. This information is presented through their branch offices, as well as their National Post-Adoption Contact Center. The Post-Adoption Contact Center is staffed by licensed, adoption-competent professionals and is available from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And we also have All Blessings International. They are an adoption agency with offices in Missouri, Kentucky, with families who work with families throughout the United States, placing children from Congo, Haiti, Hong Kong, Latvia, Taiwan, and El Salvador. And last but not least, we have the Independent Adoption Centers. Their mission is to provide open adoption placement and counseling to birth and adoptive families, and they work with families in all 50 states and are fully licensed in California, New York, Florida, Texas, and more. And we also have, let me mention, those are our gold sponsors. We also have other sponsors who provide support for our resources. You can find all of our sponsors at the service provider directory on the creatingafamily.org website. Just go to the blue horizontal menu at the top, click on the word service directory, and you can search by location and just a whole host of criteria that we think are important. Well, as I mentioned, today's show is going to be on genetics versus environment, or another way to say that is nature versus nurture. For those of you who have listened to this show for a while, you know that this is a topic of perpetual interest to me. It both feeds my natural curiosity on genetics, and also my research geek type tendencies. So it is truly a topic that I am fascinated with. This is one of our classic shows from our archives. It was a tremendous interview that we did with Dr. Matt McHugh. He is a behavioral and quantitative geneticist, but just as important, perhaps more important for the topic of this show, he is the director of the Minnesota Twin Study. We also have Dr. Kerry Yang. He is the, I think, did I say Yang? I meant Jang. He is a professor with the UBC Department of Psychiatry. He also has an extensive researcher in the area of nature versus nurture, to give it the most typical expression that people think of it as. These guys were just fascinating to me, and I, when we were going back and discussing, finding shows that have been buried in our archives that are just too good to remain buried, this was one of the first I suggested, because it has truly been one of my very favorites. So without further ado, I bring you our interview on genetics versus environment. So welcome, Dr. McGue and Dr. Siegel, to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well today, thank you. You know, I have always been fascinated by the type of twin research where twins were separated shortly after birth and raised in different environments. And maybe this is in some ways, this is because in some ways it's the opposite of what many of us are doing in our families, in which we take children with different genetics and are raising them together, which is actually part of what Dr. McGue is studying in his sibling research. But anyway, back to the twin separated at birth research. This must be one of the best ways to tease out the varying influences of genetics in the environment. Dr. Siegel, you've been studying twins separated at birth for some time. What type of similarities and differences have you seen between identical, and I guess the accurate word for that is monozygotic twins, twins that were created by the same fertilized egg, monozygotic twins raised in separate homes. What are you seeing as far as the similarities and differences between these twins?
Well, Dawn, in the study of twins raised apart that I was associated with when I was at the University of Minnesota, we studied behaviors across a wide range of domains, intelligence, personality, job satisfaction, many different medical traits, and we found that all of them showed a genetic component at some level, but the degree of genetic influence varies. It's higher for intelligence than for personality, higher for personality than for job satisfaction. And across medical traits, there was variation as well. But I think the important point is that just about everything we're able to measure in the behavioral, physical, medical domains do have some degree of genetic effects. Now, one thing I was also fascinated with in the Minnesota twins and in this sample of younger Chinese twins that I'm studying here in California is just how quickly the social relationships evolved between these people after having known each other for such a short time. And it seems that the identicals do develop a much closer social rapport than do the fraternals. And this suggests that we are attracted to people with whom we perceive that there are various kinds of similarities.
Yeah, in your book you talk about, again, I think this was with identical twins, but almost the uncanny mannerisms that people have that you would think that would be more environmentally influenced.
Well, this is something that the reared apart twins have told us, and I've seen this in the adult study as well as in the study on the younger kids. It seems that, well, there are no single genes that underlie these unusual mannerisms, whether it's using washing your hands before or after using the bathroom, as one pair did, or giggling all the time, as another pair did. But it seems that these things have multiple genetic components. And so while with a single individual, it's very easy to say, oh, if he walks like his father or talks like his father, it's simply mimicking him. But when you see this in two identical people who've been raised apart, this suggests a whole new explanation, which is that genes must play some role.
Well, yeah, I mean, you describe in one case it would flipping their hair or tilting their head when they're listening in a particular angle that was not the norm, and you wouldn't think that that has a genetic component.
That's true. That's what I saw in those young Chinese twins who were about 4 or 5, and both parents described it, and yet we don't really know how to capture this in a systematic fashion because you can't really go and study this head-tossing phenomenon across cases. But what we do find, though, that is striking is that you see these kinds of similarities much more among the identical twins than the fraternal twins. And when you see them in twins raised apart, this suggests a whole new way of explaining these things, which does take genetic factors into consideration.
Yeah. Dr. McGue, you're studying the similarities and differences between adopted siblings, siblings who share an environment but do not share their genetics. And I know it's not fair to ask you to tell us what the differences are, but generally speaking, how similar are kids who are adopted into a family and are raised in the same environment but have different genes?
Yeah, well, they're similar in two domains primarily, I would say, at least among the domains we look at. The first is in intellectual achievement. That could be IQ. That could be how they're doing in school. That could be how they do on standardized tests. The similarity is nowhere near as large as you would see among monozygotic twins, identical twins. But there is significant moderate similarity of two non-genetically related individuals growing up in the same home. Now, one of the questions with respect to that first domain is, do those effects of the home that lead to their similarity when they're growing up together, do they persist into adulthood? What we see is that when they're living together, there definitely is some modest similarity. The other domain is, I guess, what we broadly call adolescent misbehavior. So things like getting into trouble with the police, abusing substances, being skipping school, that also shows a moderate level of similarity. Not as great as you would see among genetically related individuals, but certainly something that's significant. Things that we don't see, we see virtually no similarity on, an example would be personality. So whether or not a person is an adolescent child is extroverted, neurotic, agreeable, those types of personality characteristics, they simply don't share with the siblings they're being reared with, if they're not genetically similar to them.
And that would argue then that much of what we call personality or temperament is influenced by our genes. And is that what you're saying as well, Dr.
No,
Siegel?
No, not...
Oh, no, I'm sorry, Dr. McKinney.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wouldn't want to mislead your listeners that way. What it means is whatever our personality, whatever creates our personalities, the shared family environment doesn't seem to be a powerful force in shaping our personalities. The forces are probably, based on twin studies and other studies, the type of work Nancy does, are genetic factors, but also environmental factors that are unique to each individual in a family. So environmental factors, environmental exposures that happen outside the home, or
John,
maybe that happen...
Sorry.
Yeah, Dr. Siegel, go ahead.
Yeah, can I pick up on something that Matt said a little bit earlier?
Please, yeah.
In my study of virtual twins, and let me define these for your listeners, virtual twins are same-age, unrelated children who are adopted into the home at the same time. So essentially, they're raised like twins, but without any genetic connection.
Mm-hmm.
Another way to get them is if a mother has a biological child and a near-in-age adoptee enters the home at the same time. So two ways you can get them. And I, like Matt, I also have found significant moderate similarity in general intelligence and IQ for these kids when they're on average about 6-7. But we had the opportunity to follow a group of about 45 of them from the ages of 5 until 10. And I must say that when they got to age 10, the degree of similarity dropped off fairly substantially. So what we think is going on is that this shared home environment does boost the similarity while the kids are young and while they're living at home. But as they age and as they start to acquire more control over their lives, what they do, what they read, where they go, things of that mm-hmm. sort, then these individual differences in general intelligence are going to be expressed more clearly. And some of our colleagues who have studied adopted siblings through until adolescence find that the similarity in intelligence is close to zero.
By the time they reach adolescence?
Correct.
Yeah, and that's fascinating to me. I mean, I guess in a way, what we're focusing on is that when we as parents are thinking of the concept of nature versus nurture, we're thinking of nurture being the environment that we create, the type of the style of parenting we use, or whatever. But there are so many other environmental factors outside of us that also influence our children. And you've just mentioned some. I mean, just, you know, peer influence.
The prenatal influence, too. I mean, what goes on in the womb might have some effect. And, you know, the kinds of idiosyncratic individual experiences that children have outside the home.
Right. And we're going to come at the end. I want to talk more about the prenatal. We've gotten a question that specifically relates to that, and I would like to get back to that. So I guess what I've always heard was that the The range of intelligence is set by our genes. Where in that range we fall, our environment has a strong influence. Is that still the current thinking, or am I dating myself here?
I think you're probably... Go ahead, Matt.
Go ahead, Nancy. That's fine. Go ahead.
Then you can follow me. I would say that that's probably generally correct. Experiences, degree of education is going to have an effect, but you know, you're not going to take any child and turn them into an Einstein. And I think that, you know, parents need to take realistic views of what can be accomplished and what can't. You know, we hear a lot about the value of reading and singing to children when they're young, and certainly nobody would ever deny the importance of that. But the thing is that different children will respond to those kinds of experiences differently. And for some children, it might really cause them to blossom, and for other children, it might be information overload.
That's interesting. Dr. McGee?
Nothing to add. That's fine.
Okay. You know, the other thing that I think about, too, is how personality can influence our academic achievement. A child who is very persevering is going to do better, or a child who, you know, I'm sure there are other characteristics, that temperamental characteristics. How about as far as what is the research showing about the effect of DNA or our genes on learning disabilities and things such as ADHD? Is there any evidence to say that there is a genetic component that is stronger than, say, the environmental component for that, Dr. McGee?
Well, most developmental disabilities, ADHD, Tourette syndrome, autism, learning disabilities like reading disability, are probably, if you ask in aggregate the importance of genetic factors, then genetic factors appear to be extremely important, maybe more important there than almost any other psychiatric or psychological disorders. So certainly for autism and ADHD, genetic factors and reading disability, they're very important. If you ask, well, do we know the specific genetic factors that underlie that overall aggregate genetic effect? For the most part, at this point, despite all the success of the Human Genome Project, we'd have to say largely no. But clearly, genetic factors are very important. A lot of people are trying to figure out what those genetic factors are. But we know from twin studies that genetics overall is very important.
We have a question from Karen. She says, I'm interested in this subject. I'm the mother to three children, ages 23, 10, and 5. My little one is from Korea. My two others are biological. I love them all the same. God has blessed me, and I feel especially grateful to have my youngest through adoption, but I am somewhat boggled by his behavior. Michael is a loving boy, happy, loves to draw and play with other children, enjoys helping me bake, and these are some of his wonderful traits. Here's what boggles me. He did not let go of me until he turned about 4. I had to carry him all the time. He is also very demanding, almost rude. He will not sleep alone. He never has. I love him, and that's the way he is, but I would love to hear what you think about whether these traits are just his nature. Dr. McGee, do you have an opinion on that?
Well, clearly he came. I would, if by nature she means, is it his genetic endowment? That's hard to say, because he had certain experiences before he came to join her family. But clearly he has certain dispositional qualities he came with, and she's reacting to those. It really is an illustration of something that Nancy pointed out earlier, is that his behavior, which reflects either his early experiences or his genetic inheritance, or most likely the combination of the two, but his behavior is affecting the experiences that he has now. He's shaping the behavior of his mother in getting her to respond to him in a certain way.
If I could add to that too, Don, you know, I don't know how many placements this little boy has had prior to entering her home, but one thing we do know is that when children have had multiple placements and have not had a chance to really bond to one adult, they tend to be a little clingy and a little demanding, and that child seems to fit that picture. Now, again, I think that what Matt said is true, that the child comes into this world with certain predispositions as well, but we also know that multiple placements can have this effect sometimes.
Yeah, she did not indicate that in her letter. You know, Dr. McGue, it's fascinating what you say, and I think that as a parent, sometimes I squirm to think this, but I think it is so true that our children, the individual, as individuals, influence how we parent. And we don't want to think that on some level, but of course it's true. Some kids are simply easier for us to parent, and some are not. Dr. Siegel, do you see that when you see identical twins that are being raised in two different homes? They've got different parents, and the parents' temperament is different as well.
Actually, what I'm finding, and this is more anecdotal at this point because we haven't really combed the data that systematically yet, but what I'm finding more is that the children are shaping the parents.
That's what I meant, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Now, the parents do have different temperaments, of course, and in this pair of Chinese twins that you've read about in my chapter, one little girl is being raised as an only child, and one is being raised with two older biological siblings of the parents, unrelated to her.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents of the child who's in the threesome are just so extraordinarily struck by these behaviors that they can't quite figure out where they come from. So in many ways, these parents are being molded by these kids. And, you know, you see this very clearly in fraternal twins, I think more so than with ordinary biological siblings, because fraternal twins are the same age. And I always believe that parents of fraternal twins really have the bottom line in behavior. They're the ones who can really see genetic effects so clearly.
Huh. In what way?
Well, because they have these two children who are the same age, and yet they find that they have to respond so differently to them.
Yes,
one child may be more demanding, one child may be more extroverted. You know, however the children are behaving, these parents have to sort of change their behaviors. And I think that a very important take-home message is that in order to be a good parent and a fair parent does not mean treating your children exactly the same. I think that a much better parent is one that responds sensitively to the children's own particular talents and preferences.
Well, yeah, and any of us who have more than one child ultimately have to figure that one out, even if we think that we can, even if we think that we can avoid that. Here is a question. Go ahead, Dr. McGue.
Well, just to elaborate on what Nancy said, which I think is very important, it's actually from our research, and what I believe it's an area where adoptive parents have an advantage. Adoptive parents may make fewer assumptions about the child they're rearing. They may see it more as the child as a genetic puzzle that they need to understand in order to properly parent the child. One of the things, for example, that we see in our data with our adoption studies is that parents' expectation for the academic success of their children, if they're the biological children of the parents, a typical nuclear family, then it's often based on what the parents themselves achieved. So that if they went to college, they expect their children to go to college. In the case of adoptive families, we see that their expectations are more nuanced and actually more closely match the abilities of the children than in the biological families. So adoptive parents, because they don't know as much about the child, may actually be looking at the child for signals as to how to properly parent them.
You know, I've often said that our children, it's easier to say this about adopted kids, but our kids are like a Christmas present, that we open them up and we aren't really sure what they're going to be. But with our biological children, we so often make assumptions of what they're going to be. And you're exactly right that with an adopted child, it is easier not to make these assumptions.
And yes, and still, even in a biological family, if you have more than one child, you can be awfully surprised. I mean, there can be an awful lot of Christmas presents in a home like that, because children in a family, contrary to what many people think, are very, very different.
Yes, except
extraordinarily
for the, well, except for the adults, perhaps, in a biological family, have a harder time realizing that to begin with. After a while, life tends to drill that into you, but I can see Dr. McHugh's point that adoptive families may have an advantage there. Here is a question from Tracy. How much has genetics been shown to affect obesity? Dr. McGue, you want to start with that, and then Dr. Siegel, if you have any research on that as well.
Well, if you look, there have been both twin and adoption studies of obesity. And what they suggest is obesity is a strongly genetically influenced trait. In fact, the data are rather overwhelming in that regard. One of the challenges in obesity, just like in most areas of genetics now, is to find what the underlying specific genetic factors are. What are the genes that actually lead to the genetic influence on obesity? And in this case, some progress is being made. We're beginning to understand why people are at risk for obesity in terms of their genetics. In some cases, it may be metabolic, but in other cases, surprisingly, some of the most recent genetic work suggests that people are at risk for becoming obese because they don't have a good sense of being full when they do eat. So obesity is a highly heritable trait.
But Dr. Siegel, have you done any research on this with twins? Because for me, that would be hard to, without separating the environment, how would we know? Because children who are raised by obese parents, you would think that simply habits alone would be enough to, and also the food that is being served.
Right. Well, we have looked at weight similarity in identical twins raised apart, and we do find that they do show a significant genetic component there. So it may be that eating habits and sensation of feeling full and the kinds of foods that you like, the kinds of foods that you will seek out as an adult, may be more similar. We've seen some surprising similarities in food preferences. For example, I just studied a case study of identical Korean twins, one raised in the U.S. and one raised in Korea from birth. And the surprising thing was that both twins had this real aversion to fish. And that might be understandable in a woman raised in upstate New York, but it's a little more surprising for someone raised in Seoul, South Korea, where fish
right.
is a big part of the diet. So, you know, is there, but see, this is interesting because it suggests to us, is it something about the taste, about the smell, the texture? What is it that caused them to have this aversion for it?
Mm-hmm.
So we now one other point is that we do see a somewhat stronger genetic component to weight gain and body size in males and in females, maybe because of pregnancy, hormonal effects, things of that sort. But females do tend to show somewhat less similarity than male twins do.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, other than the physical appearance, we all know the things such as eye color and ultimate heights and hair color and things like that are heavily influenced by our genetics. What other traits do you see that are most controlled by genetics, and which ones are more controlled by environment? And I realize I'm asking a really general question, so you can answer in really general terms. And again, we'll start with you, Dr. McGue, and then go to Dr. Siegel.
You're talking about behavioral traits, of course.
Yeah, well, other traits, and yes, and I'm focusing more on behavioral or temperamental or other traits, introversion, extroversion, things like that.
Well, the most heritable behavioral traits, I would say, are IQ and developmental disabilities like ADHD and autism, whereas characteristics like personality are more intermediate inheritability, and the traits that are most weakly heritable would be things like political ideology, social attitudes. Nancy mentioned earlier, I think, job satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But even in those cases, we've done work here on religiousness, which is a very interesting trait. How religious a person is, and we've looked at this in our adoptive families. And what we find is that when people are living together, when the adolescents are living with their parents, the adoptive children are very similar to their adoptive parents. And it's not just going to services; it's actually referring to religious books and for guidance. So it's not just that the parents are forcing them to go to services. So there's a lot of similarity, and it's not genetic because we're seeing it in the adoptive families. But as they grow older, and this is true, and I think Nancy mentioned this earlier, as they grow older, that similarity actually declines quite rapidly, and particularly it declines once they leave that rearing home. So yes, they might be very similar in religious beliefs when they're living together, but come back 10 years later and it might be a completely different picture. So
is that kind of arguing that genetics wins out at the end? You know, who you are is going to, once you leave the environment, you're going to be who you're going to be. Is that kind of what that's saying, Dr. McGee?
Well, I was
go ahead, Nancy.
It doesn't mean that genetics is everything. What it means is that genetics plays a stronger role, but it doesn't mean that genetics is everything. That would be a real misunderstanding of how development works.
And as Nancy pointed out before, too, is that it would be misleading to conclude that it's just our what happens is the genetics becomes determinative as we get older. In part, what happens when we get older is we gain greater control over our environments. We make choices about how we want to live, whether or not we want to pursue higher education, the people we want to affiliate with, the leisure activities we pursue. And when we're left to make those choices, we're not completely independent in making those choices. There are certainly constraints on our choices, both financially and personally. But when we are allowed to make those choices, we tend to make choices that reinforce our dispositions, mm-hmm. and our interests and our abilities. So mm-hmm. if I'm a lousy tennis player, most people who have no talent in tennis or music or whatever aren't going to spend a lot of time pursuing those activities. And the fact that we can select things based on our qualities tends to reinforce those qualities. So probably the diminishing impact of the rearing home environment may reflect the types of experiences we select for ourselves.
Yeah, and this is where you see the increasing genetic effects. And people often wonder how identical twins raised apart can be so similar when they've been raised in such different environments. And it's what we think is going on is that because they have more control of their environment, they can select those experiences and those people and those places mm-hmm. that they truly like. Just like Matt said, if your parents force you to take tennis lessons and you don't enjoy it, you're not good at it, you're probably not going to pursue that as you get to be an adult. But you asked also, Dawn, about behaviors that don't show much of a genetic effect. And
right.
I seem to recall two studies of twins that showed very little genetic effect. And these were somewhat older now and only done one time, so they certainly need replication. But one was in how quickly or slowly you fall in love. Are you the kind of person that falls in love immediately, or do you take some time to think about things? That showed very little genetic effect.
Now, that surprises me. I would think that would be a personality trait that would be genetic, not the falling in love, but impulsiveness. Yeah.
Right. Impulsiveness is, now whether that carries over into who you choose as your partner is probably another question, but again, this is only one study and has not been replicated. And the other area was in sense of humor. I've seen some mixed findings on that. So I guess the question is still somewhat out on that one as well.
How do we measure sense of humor? I mean, mine's good, yours is bad, that type of thing. But, I mean, how do you measure?
Well, you're not looking at goodness or badness of sense of humor. What you're looking at is, do people respond to the same pictures or the same words in the same way? Do they find the same things funny?
Okay, gotcha.
That would be how you would test it out.
Yeah. Slapstick humor, we both like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Now, both of those surprised me. I would have assumed the things that you find funny and how quickly you fall in love would have been a genetic component. So it just goes to show you what I don't know.
Yeah, but I caution you that those have only been done in very
right.
few instances, and we really do need more work in those areas.
Well, are the just as an aside, are the number of possible subjects of twins having been separated at birth? I would assume that is decreasing your number of subjects. Is that the case?
You would think so, but the more I stay in this business, the more I am surprised at the sheer numbers of twins reared apart that are still out there. And I think what's happening is the twins are being separated for other reasons. In the past, the studies done in the 30s and in the 60s and in the 70s and 80s when I worked with Dr. Bouchard in Minnesota, twins were primarily separated because of maternal health, maternal death, illegitimate birth was a big factor, or financial handicap of some sort. Today, twins are being separated for other reasons. One whole source are the Chinese twins that I'm studying, the one-child policy, which restricts families to two children in urban areas, two in rural areas and one in urban areas, has led to the abandonment and adoption of thousands of female babies, and twins are among them. Another source is artificial reproductive technologies, where families are willing to have multiple embryos implanted, and yet if twins or triplets or quads result, sometimes these parents are ill-equipped to manage them and will give one or two away. you know, I deal with cases all the time where there are, still are single mothers who are unable to raise twins, not due to any kind of social stigma, but simply because they don't have the financial capability or the emotional strength to do so, and twins may be separated for that reason. But adoption agencies are more sensitive to this problem now and are keeping twins together. One other case I just want to mention is that very occasionally in hospitals you get these switched at birth cases where a pair of twins and a single child are born at or about the same time, and a single baby gets switched with one of the twins. And I'm working on a fascinating case of that right now. I've spoken to some experts in this area who look at how you associate babies with mothers in hospitals. And he claims that these baby switches occur much more often. And, of course, among them will be separated twins.
Wow. Oh, gosh. I mean, every parent's nightmare.
Every parent's nightmare.
You know, there was a book, Identical Strangers,
right.
written a number of years ago. I'm sure you're both familiar with that. And in that book, and I've not read the book, it's on my list to read, but as I understand it, they were separated intentionally because there was a belief at the time that it was better for twins to be raised separately so that they could each be their individual selves. Surely that's no longer the case.
Well, here's a story on that one. There was an agency, the Louise Wise Adoption Agency in New York City in the 60s.
That's right.
And the advisor to that was Viola Bernard, who was a psychiatrist at Columbia University. And she was of the opinion that twins were better off separated because that way they would get individual attention from their parents. But that was not a research-based belief. That was just something that maybe she developed or picked up on based on one or two cases. So she advised the adoption agency to separate twins. And what happened was that there was a psychoanalyst in New York named Peter Neubauer who learned of this and decided that he would prospectively follow these twins. And he ended up following five pairs of monozygotic twins and one set of monozygotic triplets. And these parents never knew that their children were part of a twin study, never knew that they were of multiple birth status. So they weren't intentionally separated for research, but they were intentionally separated because of Viola Bernard's beliefs, but because they were separated, Peter Neubauer took them into his research.
But he never published that, and as I understand it, the results have been not classified, is not the right word, but they are not being made available until sometime in the future because of the controversy associated with the practice.
That's right. There's an archive at Columbia University under Viola Bernard's name that's been sealed for a number of years, and also one at the Yale Child Study Center where a lot of Neubauer's records have been kept. And as far as publications goes, Peter Neubauer and his son wrote one book called Nature's Thumbprint, where there's one chapter on one particular pair of twins, and then there's one article in a psychoanalytic journal on another pair, and that's really all we have.
Interesting. Well, moving on to something slightly different. One of the most difficult parts of adoption is that prospective adoptive parents are often in the position of having to make what really is a life-altering decision, both for themselves and for a child, on whether or not they should parent a particular child. And this decision is often hinged on very little information. Sometimes we have just 1 to 2 pages of information on a child and on the child's birth parent's background, but parents are then asked to decide what's right for that child and what's right for them based on this information. And sometimes certain risk factors are noted in the background, and parents want to know the relative risk that their child may develop this condition. So what I'd like to do is throw out certain of these common risk factors, or even if they're uncommon, but some of these risk factors that parents, adoptive parents, might see, and find out from you both what the heritability factors is. And I realize that you'll have to just give me a rough range, but that would be fine. What about for bipolar? Dr. McGue, do you have a feel for if, and I think we would have to almost say if one of the, either the birth mother or the birth father, so a direct in-line relative has bipolar, what are the odds that the child will have bipolar?
First thing, maybe your listeners, it's a technical issue, but it's an important one when you're talking about a family history, is saying something is... When a geneticist says something is highly heritable, it's not necessarily the same as saying that if the parent, a biological or birth parent, has the characteristic, the child is very likely to have the characteristic. So bipolar disorder is a highly heritable disorder. it affects, and it's, of course, a devastating disorder, it affects roughly 1% of the population sometime in their lifetime. It's highly heritable. It affects 1% of the population. If a parent has bipolar, the risk to a genetic parent has bipolar, the risk to the child is about 10%. So it can be highly heritable. And, of course, having a 10% risk is a tenfold increase in risk over the general population. But, indeed, the vast majority of children of a genetic parent who has bipolar do not have bipolar.
Now, let me ask you a question. Is that 10% or that tenfold increase, is that based on studies of children raised by their bipolar parents?
That's right,
or have,
yeah. But,
so
but
could
and,
it be
and,
argued
and there
that
have been
it
adoption
be-
studies.
Oh, there have been,
there have been adoption studies as well. The classic study is out of Belgium, and that would suggest that that increase, that tenfold increase, is really independent of whether or not the genetic parent reared the child.
Okay, well, that's an important distinction, it would seem.
Yeah.
All right, so, and that is whether either the birth mother or the birth father has been diagnosed bipolar.
Yeah, and if both of them were diagnosed, then you are talking about a very high level of risk.
Okay, so
I don't know that the data, maybe Nancy, you know, I don't know if the data exists for bipolar, but the same thing is pretty true for schizophrenia. In fact, the rate of schizophrenia in the general population is also about 1%. The risk, if you have a genetic parent who's schizophrenic, is 10%, so it's a tenfold increase. But if both your genetic parents are schizophrenics, then the risk is on the order of 50%.
Yeah, that sounds about right to me, Matt.
Yeah, and I don't know if the similar data exists for bipolar, but I would suspect it'd probably be very similar. So, and I'm sure your listeners can appreciate, if you're talking about genetics, then knowing that both birth parents have the characteristic is very informative. But if only one is, it's important. But again, most will not suffer the disorder that parent has.
Here comes, we have an email from Karen. My husband and I are applying to adopt from foster care. From reading over the background of some of the kids, we see really dysfunctional families and often some form of violence or criminal activity. The baby that we are fostering and hoping to adopt has had his birth father in jail for murder, and his birth mother in jail for drugs. We want to be fully prepared for what our child may need in the future. Is the tendency towards violence inherited? Is the tendency towards drug addiction inherited? Let's take what I think would probably be the easier, based on my limited knowledge. Let's talk about drug addictive type behavior, and that would, I would assume, apply to either alcohol or drugs, although I'm not sure. Dr. Siegel, how heritable is the tendency towards addictive addictions?
Well, these behaviors are heritable. I don't know what the precise figure is. It probably varies somewhat from study to study. These things are heritable, but as Matt pointed out earlier, it's not a one-to-one correspondence between parents and children, and to say that something's heritable at the level of population is quite a different thing than saying that it's going to be transmitted in a particular case. But I think that it's information that parents just may want to pay attention to so that they can make informed decisions as a child ages. I think knowing the background is important because, certain behaviors can be expressed. Maybe they can take preventive measures, but it's certainly not a one-to-one correspondence.
And that's important for our children to understand as well. They are not doomed to repeat their birth parents' mistakes just because they have those genetics.
And one way of thinking about it is that, which is what Nancy's saying, of course, too, is that what we inherit in these cases is at most a vulnerability. We don't inherit the disorders in when we're talking about behavioral disorders, but we might be more vulnerable to becoming addicted to nicotine or to alcohol. But perhaps knowing that you have some increased vulnerability, or your parents knowing that, may help in trying to better prevent that likely outcome.
Right, and it sounds like that's where Karen is going to is coming from. That's her perspective. Now, as far as violence or a tendency towards violence, I'm thinking in terms of, I'm not even sure that there are certain personality and temperamental traits, impulsivity comes to mind that could get you in trouble, but there's not, when we study personality, and I'm not speaking of sociopathic type of disorders here, I'm just speaking in general as Karen is asking about a tendency towards violence. Is that even something that is identifiable that one can test, Dr. McHugh?
The tendency towards violence?
Yeah, she was asking about the tendency towards violence, and I'm not even sure that I can, I mean, I'm trying to figure out what, that's not a measurable something that we talk about with personality. Impulsivity, for instance, would be, but.
Well, I mean, there are certainly personality questionnaires that assess aggression.
Aggression, well, that's true. I hadn't thought about aggression. That's a good point.
Yeah, and a standard personality item that gets at aggression is, I like a good fight. I mean, that's, in fact, a personality inventory that I'm sure Nancy's used very much, as well as we've used here, is that would be an item. And so it's based on self-report, but you can certainly assess by self-report or by report of others levels of aggression in individuals.
But in a dysfunctional environment, a tendency towards aggression could come out in criminal-type behaviors, and, of course, that can happen in a very functional environment, too. And in a different environment, that could be the ability to get on the debate team and really tear into your opponent and win. So I guess aggression can be expressed in any different socially acceptable or non-acceptable.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because you can channel these tendencies in different directions. If you think about some sports players, who might come from some underprivileged areas, channeling all that energy into doing very well in the sports field might be one thing, but not given that opportunity, they might end up in gangs, things of that sort. So think about this too in another example. Suppose you're born with the tendency to be allergic to penicillin, which is a very dangerous thing. If you go through your whole life without ever having penicillin, you're going to be just fine. But if you do have a shot of penicillin, that can be quite detrimental. So it really is a function of the environment that predisposition is expressed in.
Yeah, that does make sense. I'd like to move on before we run out of time to, let me read the email first and then we'll talk about it. This is from Susan. Dawn, I'm interested in hearing your guest's take on nature versus nurture via the embryo adoption. Embryo adoption is like regular adoption in that your child is not genetically related to you, but you have that additional connection in that you have grown the child inside of you and birthed and nursed it. I think it's an interesting situation to discuss in the nature versus nurture debate. And I agree with her. I think it's fascinating. And another area that I also think this comes out in, and it's happening more frequently now, is in the area of donor gametes, where either the egg or the sperm have been donated. Dr. Siegel, have you seen any research that's been done on either the donor gamete community or the donor embryo community?
But in what context?
Well, in the context of the influence between environment. Well, the first is between environment and genetics. That's the first thing. And then what I'd like to move on to is the discussion of the whole concept of epigenetics, or how the environment can influence the expression of the genes.
Well, I don't know that there'd be any greater similarity, if that's what you're getting at, between a mother who adopted a child versus a mother who actually gestated a child through embryo donation. I only have spoken to one woman who underwent this procedure, and I remember it was a very positive thing for her. She felt extremely close to that child, as if the child were hers. But, I really can't speak to that in any other way than that. One very interesting study that I have seen, though, in terms of parental satisfaction, if you're interested in that, is that there have been studies that have looked at parental satisfaction towards children that are biological, families where the child is biologically related to one parent or the other through artificial reproductive technologies, or other kinds, or the child is related to neither parent. And what's very interesting is that in the adopted cases and in the in vitro fertilization cases, parents experience more satisfaction and just a greater happiness of being a parent. And maybe that's because they've had to go through expenses and so much difficulty to have the child, but I thought that was an interesting finding.
When you say more satisfaction, compared to what? Compared to an adopted?
Compared to ordinary biological parents and children. Ordinary parents who have biological children.
So parents who have conceived through IVF were showing a greater percentage of satisfaction than parents who conceived naturally.
Right, with the parental role.
Mm-hmm. How about with adoptive? Was that part of the study?
Yes, they did use adoptive there, and that really fell more into the group of the people who did the ART, the artificial reproductive technologies, in order to get children.
So also
biological parents who stood alone.
So adoptive parents and children and parents who have conceived through assisted reproductive technology showed a greater percentage of satisfaction. Well,
yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Do either of you have any information then on if there's been any research, or even can you can we extrapolate from other research as to the prenatal environment and how it influences the expression of genes? And let me say to begin with that I'm aware of the negative influence in things such as severe malnutrition or through alcohol exposure. That's an example where clearly there's a negative influence on how the genes are going to be expressed because of the poor prenatal conditions. But what about where there isn't a necessarily a negative influence? There is a belief, and in particular the donor gamete, donor egg community, that the mother, by the fact that it's her environment and her uterus that the child is growing in, is actually contributing to the ultimate expression of the genes in that child. Dr. McGee, is there any evidence to support this? Do you know of?
Yeah. So this is the area, as you alluded to earlier, called epigenetics. And what epigenetics essentially means is that there can be changes that affect how genes are expressed. And this area of research is very exciting, but it's really in its infancy. And we really know much more now from model organisms, from mice and rats, about epigenetic phenomena than we do on humans, although we presume that the same phenomena are going on in humans. It's just harder to study them. So, for example, the classic study in this area, and by classic, it's not that old,
yeah.
But yet it's a wonderful demonstration of how maternal factors can have a long-lasting impact on gene expression. In this case, they took mice who were prone to obesity, this particular type of mouse, and they fed the mothers either a diet that was rich in a certain substance called folate, which is they actually did through by giving the mothers garlic, or they didn't give the mothers garlic. And what they found is that the mice that were were in utero with a mother eating a lot of garlic, when they grew up, they weren't obese, whereas the other ones retained the obesity quality of that particular strain of mice. And the reason for that, the difference in risk of obesity, they could actually show through very careful molecular studies, really stem from how the mothers were eating. The mothers were eating garlic, they didn't get an obese child, in this case, a mouse pup. But the ones that didn't ended up with an obese pup. And it was how that diet, maternal diet, affected the expression of the genes in the two types of pups. So we know these things occur. There are other examples, again, in mice and rats, that maternal behavior very early in life and in utero can have long-lasting effects by changing gene expression. What the implications are for humans now, I think it's just too early to tell because the researchers haven't worked out the relevant systems.
I think that newborn or new mothers, or rather pregnant mothers, are being encouraged to have folate supplements as a way of preventing spina bifida. I think that's right.
Yeah, that's already happening, sure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, not only that,
this
but
is
a lot
different
of
phenomena.
That would seem to be a different phenomena. Well, you know, the whole area of embryo donation is rife for study. Now, how you find your subjects, I don't know, but here you have genetically related embryos being transferred into different non-genetically related women. And if those offspring could be studied, that would be an interesting way of perhaps figuring out some more information on the...
The problem with that, though, Dawn, would be that those embryos would not be genetically alike. They would be genetically related.
Correct.
I suppose the ideal experiment is one that we never can do, and that would be to take split embryos, monozygotic twins, and implant them into different uteruses. But that's, you know, the impossible experiment.
Yeah. And thank goodness, I would add.
Yeah, at least when it comes to humans.
Yeah, well, when it comes to humans, for certain. Dr. McGee, you've been studying adoptive families, and this may be a little unfair, but in your studies, have you come up with certain traits that adoptive families can have that you see that correlate to adolescents and adults, adopted adolescents and adults, who are doing well by any of the measures that you use to measure doing well? In other words, tell us how we need to be good parents.
Oh, boy. that is a hard question, especially at the end of the end of the hour. But
yeah, exactly. Sum it all up in a party. Go ahead.
It's going to sound like a little cop-out, and I suppose it is, but it's actually accurate, is we began the study, our adoptive family study, in order to better understand family influences, family environmental influences, because psychologists for 100 years have been trying to understand family environmental influences by studying families that are also genetically related, and it was never clear what the basis for the associations they were observing. So, for example, we used to think that schizophrenia was due to having a schizophrenogenic mother until we actually did the genetic research to show that really that probably reflected some sort of genetic mechanism. So in our case, we're trying to understand, I think, from a very new perspective of how families work, and we're only at the early stages here as well. I actually think that the types of outcomes I'm looking at, which is primarily adolescent deviant behavior, that parents in adolescence have much weaker influence on those traits than the other siblings in the family do. So one of the things we're focusing in on is not the parents, but the older sibling. So if we're talking about drug abuse, if nothing else but getting access to illicit substances, we actually think the older siblings in a home, in an adoptive home, may be having a greater influence, both positively and negatively, than the parents in those homes. There are certainly factors that parents have an influence on too, but at this point it's hard to summarize that in a short period of time.
Do you mind if I quote you to the older children in my family to put a little more pressure on them? I expect you to behave. Dr. Siegel, have you come up with anything in your studies as far as environmental things that we as adoptive parents can do?
Well, I guess what I said before, Dawn, is just to really be sensitive to that particular child's behaviors. You know, it's not even so much in adoptive families. I think it's in all families. The children are just going to be very, very different. And one great example I can give you is a family I studied where the mother naturally conceived quadruplets, but they came out as two sets of monozygotic twin boys. So there you had two sets of monozygotic twins and four sets of fraternal twins, if you pair them every which way. And, you know, these are kids raised at exactly the same time in the same place, were enormously different. And the mother had to really alter her rearing style to make it compatible with each child. So I think that's really the bottom line for families, whether it's biological or adoptive.
Well, on that perfectly good note to end, that sums things up really well. I had read a quote, and when a psychologist was asked which had more influence, nurture versus nature, he said it would. He could only respond by asking which contributes more to the area of a rectangle, its length or its width. And that's really what I'm hearing from you, is that there are certainly genetic influences, but they're not overly controlling any more so than our environmental influences. Dr. Matt McGee and Dr. Nancy Siegel, thank you so much for being our guest today on Creating a Family. To get more information on Dr. McGee's fascinating studies, you can go to, now get your pen out, this is one of those what they call ugly URLs, it's a tough one, mctfr.psych, which is psych, .umn, for University of Minnesota, .edu. For more information on Dr. Nancy Siegel's research, where should they go, Dr. Siegel?
They can go to my website, which is www.psych.edu/nsiegel, or they can try Amazon.com for my two books.
Yeah, and or ask your local bookseller to buy them, to stock them, because they are well worth it. If you have found this show helpful, please post about it and link to it so others can listen as well. As a nonprofit, we are truly dependent on your help in spreading the word. If you agree or disagree with what we've said today, start a discussion about it on Facebook or on your blog or in any of the forums you participate in. We want to get people talking and thinking about this subject. This show will be archived on the 2009 Big List at the radio page of creatingafamily.org, and it's also available for download as a podcast from iTunes. And the easiest way to get it from iTunes is just to use the iTunes button on the radio page at our site. Our shows are evenly divided between infertility and adoption. On next week's show, which will be December 16th, we'll be looking at the evidence on how acupuncture can affect the success of IVF and other fertility treatments. So please join us and tell others about the show. See you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations. The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
The moon, yeah. That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-o! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.